All right, I'll try to. I need a cough button or whatever. What do they call that in radio? Anyways, mute button. Yeah, there's a cough. There's a certain one I think though they can do that does. Anyways, whatever. So I hope you guys are doing well today, and we all made it here at the right time. Hopefully, no one was been sitting here for an hour. I was thinking having the women's retreat on the same weekend of the time change. That's quite the recipe for disaster. So I was gonna be amazed if anyone showed up. But anyway, so we'll start off. We'll review last week. Were most of you guys here last week with Josh? So, which one? Which aspect of it? Yeah, I'm not so sure he would if he actually lived it for a week. So go ahead and review with me what you guys got from that, what you covered, and then we'll kind of go from there, build off of that. Oh yeah, did he bring his daughters? Oh. Did his whole family come? No? Oh.
If they did, he didn't introduce us to
them. Okay. I don't think they did. They go to Calvary. So I'm guessing they were there. Yeah, Calvary, I'm pretty sure, is where they go. Yeah.
It was a meandering conversation.
Okay. So we covered a wide variety of ground. And was there a challenge? He said something about this. We've been trying to work out how do we do this to where we can do some intentional things as we go through the training process once we get further along. So anyways, he said something about that, but I didn't get the details. Zuma?
He gave us a challenge to pray.
Okay.
The Lord would basically give us an opportunity
okay.
to put into practice what we've been talking about.
Okay. Specifically. Yeah. Yeah, and that's what we've been saying is that's a good starting point. So has anyone had an opportunity since then or one that's getting set up? Anything?
Yeah, it happened at Jars. A young man and his wife were here for about a year, pilots.
Okay.
And it started him and another pilot might come over to for dinner.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, so there's an extra challenge in reaching non-Christians for those of us in ministry and around mostly other Christians. So that's a whole different ball game than someone who's kind of in more of a secular work environment. So we have to be more intentional in creating those opportunities if we're going to. So it's finding neighbors that aren't or thinking about what are things we can do. One, I don't need to get into it a whole lot here today, although I guess it wouldn't hurt if we did, but one thing I've been trying to think through is how do we develop an intentional plan to use the hobbies, things that we enjoy doing best, to create intentional, not doing them only to evangelize people, but doing things we enjoy, but intentionally doing them, asking God that would be an opportunity to meet people who we can share with. And so whatever that hobby might be for you, whether it's woodworking or whether it's, you know, model trains or whether it's fishing or whether it's whatever it might be, sewing, embroidery, whatever, finding ways that you can get involved in something where you have that commonality with someone. And even if you don't have Christianity in common, you have something else in common that's going to draw you a lot closer. And so the term I've used for this is subculture evangelism. You know, we've got all these little subcultures where you can get really into a niche activity. And the people involved in it have a camaraderie automatically because you have this shared passion. Where this started to become really clear to me was back in college, I had gotten really into rock climbing. Specifically, kind of climbing where you don't use ropes, it's called bouldering. So you climb boulders instead of tall routes on cliff faces, you're climbing boulders. And so one of the big advantages of bouldering, especially for the social aspect, is you're typically doing things that are a lot harder that you're not going to get it the first time. That's kind of the idea. You're trying to find things that push you, and so you might work on the same section, the same boulder, the same route, whatever it would you'd want to call it, problem is what the technical term when you're doing bouldering. You'd work on it for a long time. So when we'd go to an outdoor place, we would end up climbing with people. We'd kind of find people about in our same level. We'd go as a group, and we'd be all over the map, you know, some beginner, some intermediate, some getting more advanced. And so we'd end up finding other people at wherever we had went, because you would be climbing the same types of things, and eventually you'd start to, hey, we're going to go over here next, and you'd start working together. Well, especially, I mean, you automatically had this camaraderie there that was pretty deep, but especially if you were one of the better ones, or if you were working on something and you were the first one to get it. And I had gotten fairly good, and we were on a trip and ended up getting a fairly difficult problem boulder, working with a group of three or four guys, and then they had some people with them. Well, automatically, whatever I said, I was like the expert at everything all of a sudden, right? It made no sense at all, okay? I could climb this rock well, so therefore, whatever I say about these other subjects that are completely unrelated, you know, I must have something to say. And so they were, you know, these sort of Buddhist hippie kind of whatever, New Age. And yet they would listen to anything I had to say about Christianity and, you know, Bible. And but I'd ground it in a context where I'd find common ground with them. But still, it was that shared passion that they were open. The walls were down. There weren't any barriers. There wasn't any anger. And so we started to find this consistently that we could really do this. And so what would happen, we would go out climbing during the day, and then you'd go back to campsite or whatever at night and be cooking food together, sitting around the campfire, and just the conversations. It was so easy to have really fruitful conversation. And so there are things for you guys, most likely, passions that you have, coding or whatever it might be, that you could use to either find people, like-minded people, or you could use to mentor. And that can be a situation where then we have opportunities to share. So for those of us in ministry, we have to get more creative, especially if we live in a situation like we're at JARS, right? Or especially, really, if you live out near JARS and you work at JARS, right? So now you've got to, if you want to do evangelism, you're going to have to be very, very intentional. And so that could be, you know, something we might do, probably not this fall still, but probably starting next year in 2019, is start to do some surveys of the community. And so we'll come up with a survey that will really give us an understanding of where are the people of Waxhaw at. You kind of sometimes know, but I'd really like to have a better understanding. And so figuring out what are the common backgrounds, what are the common hang-ups people have, reasons that they think Christianity is true or not true, most common.
If you end up coming on staff, is that going to be an area of focus?
Yeah, so I don't think I'll be on staff. I mean, if I get through the elder process, I still probably won't be compensated staff, but we'll do it as on the volunteer. I mean, whatever you mean.
I misunderstood when they were saying, what do you think about this guy? I thought it was a paid staff.
Well, yeah. So there's not really, as I understand it, there's not really a distinction in the elders are elders. It's just we have some that are compensated and some that are not. So I would be one of the uncompensated, bivocational. No, that's fine. But yeah, that's still part of it. So yes, the answer is not because I'm coming on staff, but yes, that is something that will be part of my outreach. So if we have a title, it would be something like involving outreach. So that's a way that we could figure out where are people at, and we could do that consistently. We could go out in groups. You could go downtown. We could especially be doing that when there's the parades and the festivals and all that kind of stuff. And it's a way to both find out where people are at so we know, okay, if this common question or this common background keeps coming up over and over and over and over, well, it's a good idea for us to probably have a session where we intentionally train people, because if it's coming out on 40% of the surveys we do, then if you're reaching out at all, you're probably going to run into this in our area. And so what exactly those things are, we have to do some work to find out. You know, what we've thought about as far as our ministry with Engage 360 is the easy ones are if we're doing something in somewhere in Utah, right? Mormonism is the automatic. You're going to have to be prepared for that. If you're in somewhere up in near Detroit now, Dearborn, Michigan, Islam is going to be very common. So you're going to have to be prepared for that. What those most common things are here, you know, I have some guesses, but I'd like to get some data that really backs that up. And so that's something we could do. But then those surveys can become an opportunity where you can say, you know, that's really interesting. Could I share? Would you mind if I share? And now you have an opportunity to kind of pour into them. Or if they ask a really interesting question, to say, you know, that's a really interesting reason, or that's a really interesting question. I've never heard that before. Could I follow up with you? You know, could I get your email, or could we get together for lunch next week? And so, again, a lot of us here probably are going to be around Christians most of the time. And so if we're going to be serious about evangelism, we're going to have to intentionally put ourselves in positions to do so. Other people that work in a secular environment, it's all around them every day, right? And so we're trying to figure out where is each person and how do we help them in their given situation to be effective in outreach. And so in thinking about the question, we'll kind of continue along the lines of a discussion on the why does it matter. What are reasons you guys, or things people say, or situations that they're in, where there's grounds where we could engage in that conversation on bridging towards spiritual matters, specifically Christianity and the gospel? We may not go straight to the gospel, but what are situations you guys can think of that you've had happen? If you have stories, share those. Where there was a life situation that was the bridge for the person having this ache, this need that they filled in.
For me, the hunting community is that. In 2015.
I'm not hearing it at all.
Well, come up there. Stand up. Okay, I'm coming. In 2015, I was in Colorado with on an archery elk hunt with who was at that time Elijah's soccer coach, and he was not a believer, nominally Catholic, from up north, and probably thinks that he's Catholic, but doesn't really act Catholic. Anyway, so we had the opportunity, we drove to Colorado, and so, you know, 27, 28 hours in the car, and then we hiked 4 or 5 miles into the White River National Forest and camped out for a week at 11,000 feet, and then hiked back and drove all the way back. So we had a lot of opportunity for conversation. And he knows who I am and what I do and what we're about and all that sort of stuff. But there was one moment throughout the week where things really kind of, there was that opportunity. And so we're literally, like, there's no cell service. Our only connection to the outside world is his GPS device. That it's got an emergency beacon, it's all that sort of stuff. But it's a 3-hour hike to get to cell service. And so we're out hunting one morning. Now, he's also a former Marine. He was an orienteer in the Marine Corps, so I felt very good about being out there with him. That being said, we're hunting Wednesday morning, and we come back to camp for lunch. He puts his bag down, and he realizes that the GPS device is missing. It had been hanging from his bag, and like that's our communication line to the outside. We had been texting our wives every night saying, "Hey, we're safe, we're good, no thunderstorms, whatever." And now, and he said, "My wife is the type of lady that if she doesn't get a call tonight, if she didn't get a text tonight, she's going to send a helicopter." she's Italian Catholic. If that makes any sense to. So he says, we got to shut it down. We got to go back because they're going to think that there's something wrong with us. And he's like, we'll give it one shot. We'll go look for it. We'll go to where we hunted this morning, see if we can find it. But again, we're hiking in the mountains. I mean, it's not roads, it's not trails. It's just in the timber, in the mountains. And so before we left, I said, Steve, just can you just hold on a second? Do you mind if I just pray real quick? Because I don't know where this thing is. You don't know where this thing is, but I believe that God knows where it is. And so he's like, yeah, that's fine. And so we stopped and we prayed. And now I'm like, okay, God, you have to show us this thing because I totally laid it out there and this is going to be really bad if we don't find it. So we hiked all the way to about a mile to the pond that we were hunting at that morning. We hiked out there and it wasn't where he was sitting. And the whole time I'm like praying, I'm like, we got to find this thing, we got to find this thing. And I mean, it's not even a needle in a haystack. It's like a needle in a thousand pieces. Because this device is like this big and those mountains are that big. We get out there, we don't find it. We make the decision, we're going to go back to camp, we're going to pack up camp, we're going to leave. And we're going to head back home to North Carolina. We come all the way back to camp. He's devastated. I'm now like, well, great. Now I said God's going to come find it. And so he puts his bag down. I got back to camp first. I put my bag down. And he was like 100 yards behind me. And I started walking back towards him. And I put my foot up on a log like this, just waiting for him. And I was tired because we're hiking at 11,000 feet. And I rested my arm on my knee and I looked down and right underneath that log was that GPS device. And I was like, you have got to be kidding me. I'm like, Steve, what color was that thing? He's like, well, yellow and black. I'm like this? And he's like, I can't believe you found it. He's like, God really does listen to you.
Like, maybe.
Yeah. It worked out. But what was funny was, then on the way home, he was in the midst of job change. He had a job interview. And so on the way home, driving in the car, he asked me to pray for him.
Mm.
And so it wasn't like, we didn't have like a gospel. I didn't have like an altar
call. Right, right.
On the GPS device. But it was just continuing that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Even to this day, we still continue that conversation. So that was my...
That's great. Yeah, no, that's a great story. Yeah, and there's just that, like, and that's why I think the subculture idea, this intentionality, every story doesn't have to veer off on that direction, but why I think it's so fruitful is because a lot of the barriers are already down, because we have common ground with that person, camaraderie. What about other situation or stories?
People can use in the workplace, because I did it. I got a new job in customer service, phone work for a certain bank. And I would take my Bible in with me.
Okay.
And my manager told me point blank in front of another supervisor, I don't ever want to see you reading that Bible in there, in the floor. But yet people were allowed to bring all kinds of books and magazines. He just didn't want to see the Bible.
Mm.
So I said, well, Lord, I'm going to bring the Bible and I'm still going to read it.
Right.
But I told him, the reason I bring my Bible is I can look at it sitting on my desk. And it'll bring me back down to earth and help me be a better employee there.
Right.
And so he never confronted me.
Right, right. Okay, that's great. That's great. Well, other questions or like life situations people run into where that question of why is going to come up that creates a context?
I had one a couple weeks ago. My manager... short version of the story is there were practices in that company that can be kind of rough on employees, and as my manager and I are having a one-on-one meeting and he's telling me how things are going to be, and I said, that's, you know, fine, whatever's good for the bigger picture of the company, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a right to a job, you know. Mm-hmm. You guys aren't obliged to give me a job. And he says, I appreciate how well you're taking this. And I said, and I've reported him for a year or two, and I've never had this kind of talk with him, but for whatever reason, I thought
it
was a good time to step in. And I said, well, I'll tell you some of the thinking behind that. My understanding of the Bible is I've fallen short of what God expects of me, and that God has been willing to forgive me for being, as the words I use with my boss in the workplace is, God has been willing to forgive me for being the jackass that I am.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's not a new word for my boss, for me, I'll tell you. And so having come to that point in my life where I've been forgiven, I try each day to say, okay, how can I make choices that will make it a little less likely that God is going to say, oh, why did I do that? I so that's kind of, you know, what's behind it a little bit. I didn't know when, but I knew that it was like two business days later that a bunch of us got laid off. And I thought, I got that little plug.
There you go. Yeah. Still, right, exactly. Very good. Any others? Yeah, Danny?
And I was just thinking about my life, and I remember saying to myself, you know, I am all about Christianity as long as it doesn't cost me anything.
Yeah.
I exited off my exit, and it was starting to rain, which is rare in Phoenix. But there was this guy and girl pushing two baby carriages. Mm-hmm. And I pulled up alongside of them and said, do you want to ride? And they said, sure. You know, so they got in the car and I took them. They were staying at this hotel. And I took them over there, and the kids were really young, you know.
Oh.
And so I let them out, and I knew what room they were in. And so I knew they didn't have anything to eat. So I went to the grocery store and bought things that they could have in a hotel room.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought it to them, and they invited me in.
Oh, wow.
So I went in and sat down with them for a little bit, and I just said, you guys have any idea what the gospel is? And they go, no. So I shared the gospel with them right there.
Wow.
We developed a relationship, and they were working with a ministry, which I got in touch with the ministry. The ministry put them there, you know. And it's a long story, and it's a long story. But after that, I mean, it lasted for several months. I don't think I would ever do that again.
Because what? Because it got latchy?
No. I still have the text on my phone. That ministry, and I helped, I mean, but there were three men that actually, one of them found her a job because she was employable. He wasn't. They were married. And we found them an apartment and funds to get them sit in an apartment. She was working. He was at home with the children for the time being. He sends me a text one day and goes, because I was going over every week and having a Bible study with him.
Mm-hmm.
He sends me a text and says, would it bother you if I'm dressed like a woman when you get here tonight? And I said, yes, actually it would. I think. I have it written down. I have it on my phone. Come to find out during the day, he was dressing like a woman and walking around with children, and he was just horrible for the children and all the other things he was doing. And the two men, and we all went in there and said, look, they ran out of money because they just weren't managing it. He was giving it away, you know.
Spending, right.
And I just said, look, one guy with us, he goes, look, put your girls' clothes. He says, we're not paying for you. We're not going to help you unless you're willing to help yourself.
Uh-huh.
Get your girls' clothes right now and bring them to me in a plastic bag.
Because
they were asking us for help.
Uh-huh.
And he goes, he was like dilly-dallying around, and then his wife goes, go get them, you know. And finally, the one guy, he just goes, that's it, we're out of here. And she went with us. She wanted to go with us. And their whole family just blew up.
Yep.
And I thought, I don't think this is the way it was supposed to go.
Yeah, well, it's difficult, those types of situations. Very messy. Life is very messy for a lot of people. And it's what's difficult is how do we find the balance between meeting people there, loving them, but not enabling, right? And so that's the challenge with we have social outreach ministries is how do you find that line? And some have developed really good practices as to how they do it so they're not just enabling, but it is a challenge. And that we're incorporating sort of a spiritual growth component. And that if there's no interest there and it clearly becomes a situation where it's just being used, then, you know, drawing that line. But it is really difficult because those people certainly need it as much as anyone, right? And so you, man, that's a hard situation. And that is one of the things if we're actually intentional about reaching into people's lives is it is going to get a bit messy. When we did college campus ministry, and I'll come to you in just a second, when we did college campus ministry, I mean, that was similar there where, you know, there were a lot of opportunities, but gosh, a lot of those kids, their lives were a mess, an absolute mess. And, you know, it was difficult to work through some of that and to know what they were going through and to see in the end how easy it would be for them to be in a totally different situation, but to watch them just kind of know that and have that and just kind of keep doing it. But, you know, we just trust that we have to be wise, and there is a point where we draw the line, but that we need to show that love and grace as much as we can and trust that that will be there, even if in the end it doesn't work out, like in this situation, that's, they can't, for the most part, without intentionally suppressing it, they can't unremember that and what happened there. And so, you know, who knows? It could be 10 years down the road that ends up causing a shift and a change.
I'm just going to piggyback off. I had a similar experience. So I was playing pool in a billiard league. My desire, I had different desires, but one of them was to be a light in the darkness there.
Mm-hmm.
And a new guy on the team came up to me and said, "You need to tell me something, okay? I like to dress up like a woman. How would that affect you?" And so I see total validity in the way you guys handle it. I believe the Holy Spirit told you to act that way. In my case, I told him, it won't bother me. I won't judge you. And I still have a relationship with him on Facebook to this day.
Mm-hmm.
So he could handle it either way, really.
Right. Well, and with those types of really sensitive things, too, it's showing someone that I can still love you without affirming what you do. I had a homosexual coworker, and she said she was a Christian, but she was very much against any sort of like typical organized Christianity. It was an odd thing, and it was really more of just a way of kind of affirming her own views. This movement that she went to an all gay church. And so it was this thing that was more than that. So she certainly didn't have much of an understanding, came out of a really bad background. But anyway, so she knew where I stood, and we would talk about it very openly and very directly. But she knew that I also genuinely loved her and cared for her and was interested in her good, and I would tell her that. And she had some, you know, so eventually she started to open up a bit more and you know, told me about her past, and she had just a terrible, terrible situation. Was abused by her, sexually abused by her parents. So then she got taken, ended up getting put into a home and got abused there. So then they put her in a Catholic-run orphanage type thing, and she got abused by the nuns there. So this girl was abused pretty much from 0 to 6 years old, okay, by almost everyone in her life. Now, I'm not surprised she has a lot of challenges, right? And so she told me one day, as she had opened up about this, she says, I know this is just how God made me. I know because I remember I was sexually attracted to women when I was 5 years old. And I said, you know, I don't doubt that you feel that way, but don't you think it's odd that you even knew what sexually attracted was at that age? that you had any idea what that is? I said, and she said, well, yeah, I guess I've never thought of it that way. I said, so your situation is terrible. What's happened to you should never happen to anyone. It's a sign of the absolute utter brokenness of our world. But I don't think you can use that as a situation to normalize something. Like what happened to you is completely abnormal and very much not what should. And so that's not going to justify anything. And what I had made clear to her all along was, and she had been living, I don't know if it had started after I had gotten to know her, but she was living sort of an abstinent lifestyle. And I was telling her, look, you may never be able to change the way you feel. I don't think there's anything wrong with praying or seeking counseling if you would ever come to that, but you may never change that, you know. But that's not the problem. The problem is acting on it, right? And even then, that's still not a reason for me not to love you. I'm just going to say, I don't think that's good for you. That's biblically, spiritually, emotionally, physically, it's not good for you. So I can't affirm you in it because I wouldn't be able to say I love you if I affirmed you in it because I know it's not good for you. I'm not just judging you. I'm not saying you're an inferior person for feeling that way. I'm not saying I hate you. I'm not saying, you know, anything like that. I don't wish God's judgment on you for that. I hope, you know, nothing but grace for you in your situation. But I can't affirm you in it because I know it's not healthy for you. I know that's not a healthy lifestyle. I know you're not going to find healthy relationship there. And so out of love, I held that. And she had never made that. She said, I've never met a Christian who could explain that to me and who actually could. I've never met anyone, I think she even said, who didn't affirm me in my homosexuality, but still showed me love. And she made that decision. Now, not everyone's going to see that, but we have to, in those situations, try to be that difference. And it doesn't mean affirming everything, but it means showing people love and compassion to the degree we can, not enabling unhealthy behavior, but showing them love in spite of whatever the mess that they live in is, because a lot of people, their life is really messy. And so we have to do that. And that brokenness is a place for where we can have a bridge to build towards the gospel. And so, you know, with this girl, I said that. So that's why I think, you know, and she thought she was a Christian, so it was kind of tricky to nuance. But her Christianity was all about affirming homosexuality and not the gospel. So it was cleaning that up. She knew about some of the Christian message. It was cleaning that up. But that was the opportunity that gave me the ground to do it.
A number of years ago in the early 90s, I'm sort of a person that has to be pushed in.
Okay. Right, right, right.
And I'm the type that has to sort of be pushed in.
Mm-hmm.
And we had an employee, I don't know, he probably worked with us 6 months or so.
Mm-hmm.
And he come up one day and he said, I'm going to have to quit. And I said, Bill, why is that? I knew why. But I asked him.
Right.
And he said, well, you know, I've been late a lot. I'm on drugs. I can't get up. And he said, I can't kick it. And he said, I'm going to have to leave. And so I said, well, that's fine, Bill Lane, but you're going to hear what I have to say before you leave. Looking out on the steps, and we sat down, and I shared the Lord with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him that. That the only way he was going to shake this is through the Lord Jesus Christ. And I explained that to him.
Mm.
Well, a couple of 3 years later, we built a new building in 92 or so, 91, and the recession hit.
Mm.
And one of our biggest customers, who we sort of built the company on,
mm-hmm.
called and said, I don't know what the upper people are thinking, but they say they're going to make their own ballast boxes in-house. And I said, Jerry, they can't do that. They can't keep up. He said, I know that, but nevertheless. So that was 2 or 3 years later, right?
Not me.
That was 2 or 3 years later. And we were pretty desperate because was ahead and went up a third, and your business went down a third.
So right.
Brendan had
not a good ratio.
If things don't change by Friday of this week,
mm-hmm.
then we're going to lay everybody off and we're going to go at it at ourselves. Well, on Monday or Tuesday, Billy Wayne shows up after 3 years, and he says, "I've been looking for you for a number of years." And he says, "I got something I want to tell you."
Okay.
And he said, "I was at the point of committing suicide."
Wow.
"And somebody came by my house and said, there's a revival going on at this such and such church, and you're going to go with me." And he got saved.
Wow.
And he says, "It took me a year to run you down, but I remembered what you said and what an impact it had on my life." He said, "It all came back."
Hmm.
And he left, and the two of us just cried.
Hmm.
On Thursday, Amita, who was the big customer I have, Jerry called me. He said, "I need 800 ballast boxes by Monday. Our guys can't do this."
Now they're twice as much.
When we just want to lay everybody off and go ahead.
Wow. Wow. That's incredible.
So, the Lord showed us.
Right.
And if Billy Wayne hadn't showed up, you know, what would have happened? Probably, maybe everything would have worked out.
Right.
But the fact that he walks in the door and says,
right,
"I've been saved and I want you to know it."
Right. Right.
So, like you said.
Right.
And there was another case just like that.
Right. And the thing is, with that situation, with anyone in the midst of addiction, despair, they're asking the questions, why should I go on, why does this matter? And specifically for addicts, they're not going to have much of a problem understanding sin, right? Because the addict is at the point where they love their sin so much that they can't stop themselves from indulging. But they simultaneously hate their sin so much, like in this situation, that they consider ending their life to stop from doing it. And so they understand that challenge, and they're in that spot where they're, you know, rock bottom. I think this is a place where people respond to the gospel and where God can move, because so many people, there's no pretension about their sin. They're not saying, "I'm not a sinner. Oh, I'm perfect. I got everything figured out." They know they're a mess. And, you know, that's really a big part of the gospel, is you need people to recognize that they're a mess. That was my challenge when I was an atheist, was I was outwardly, I was a very moral person. I was more moral than most of the Christians I knew. And when they were presenting it as, well, you know, you just makes you a good person. It's just about being a good person. I thought, well, I'm already a good person, based on the standards of I'm better than, morally better than the Christians around me, and I'm not a Christian, so if they're good, then I'm definitely good, right? And that was the way they presented Christianity, as it was about being good. Well, no, if they would have just said, well, no, Christianity is all about how nobody can be good enough. I'm not good enough just because I go to church, and you're not good enough, you know, even though you do live. It's not about that. It's about, are you perfect? You know, have you had any flaw? Do you have any mistakes, anything you've ever done wrong? Have you ever done any? And I never really understood that, so.
Well, and another thing I left out is, you know, we were in a crisis at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And when he walked in the door, he said, "Do you remember me?" And I said, "Yeah, you're Billy Wayne." I don't even remember his last name.
Mm-hmm.
I remember
his right.
And Billy Wayne said, "Well, I've been looking for you a long time." And he said, I don't know what y'all are going through right now, but whatever you're doing, stay with it."
Oh, okay. Wow.
And that was, I mean, you know, God not only...
Right, use that to encourage you, right.
Return, he helped
us.
Step one state.
Yep, absolutely. Yep. And so that's what I was kind of wanting to look at, is what are those situations, and what are the questions people are asking that is that opportunity, whether it's something where we can just directly share the gospel with them, because there's a context that makes sense there, whether it's something where we can plant a seed or water. But those situations and the questions that come up, and so maybe to finish up here, can you guys think of anything? Are there any, whether it's a situation you've been in or have heard of or hypothetically, where there are questions that are going to come that are the thing we have to deal with? What are the hang-ups people would have? So in the midst, like I'll load one and then we can go from there. So in the midst of suffering, go ahead, Paul. Yeah. Sure.
Louder. I don't know if you touched on this when I stepped out, but back to your scenario with the girl.
Yeah.
The conversation that you had with her, that was not the first conversation you ever had.
No.
I think that's something that it was the relationship that you had with her that gave you the foundation to be able to have that conversation with her.
Right.
Where we get it twisted as Christians a lot of the time is we think we got to go in guns blazing.
Right.
And get rid of that bad situation.
Right.
As opposed to
meeting the people,
right?
Right.
And I think that's where we have to realize that we have to, Jesus met people where they were at, and then he called them to something greater.
Right. So yeah.
I think it would be wise for us to learn from his example.
Yeah, but just for the recording, and anyone didn't hear, what Paul was saying is, back to my story with my homosexual coworker, that those deep conversations we had were not the first conversations. They were after a relationship had been built. And so I think that is something to have in mind. And what we want to do is we want to be prepared, and I think I've discussed this in here. Like I've said a couple of times, I get confused between what we've done at Carmel and what we've done here. So if I'm repeating, I apologize. But yes, I know that part I've said. I'm just going to apologize for it again because I wish I could keep it straight. But now I've lost my train of thought. No. So what we want to do is go into conversations or as we're being intentional, looking for opportunities in our lives, whether they're with people we just met or that we've known for a long time. We don't want to go in preloaded with the gospel on one end of the spectrum or the other, and here's what I mean by that. It's not every conversation is a failure unless you've shared the words of the gospel, you know, that Jesus died for your sins and whatever you're going to say it, you know. That's a failure if you didn't bring that up. You weren't evangelizing, right? You weren't sharing your faith. That I think is an error, because a lot of people don't even have a context in which the gospel can make any sense at all. And so my personal, and I'm open to being corrected on this, but I don't think it's the gospel if the person is not in a context to have any conception of God, of sin, of the things that are necessary. To the idea of having an eternal relationship with, like for an atheist, with the tooth fairy, that isn't the gospel. So until we've helped that person understand the difference between the tooth fairy and God, we can use the words of the gospel, but we haven't shared the gospel. It's like a foreign language or gobbledygook, okay? So that's one end of the spectrum, is we always have to, or it's a failure. The other end of the spectrum that we can be in error is, well, we have to. Now, this isn't to counter my story or what Paul was saying, but that we have to have a long relationship before we have the right. I've heard some people say, well, we need to do all these things to have the right to speak. And it's like, no, we definitely don't. That the person is separated from God gives us the right to. The question is, what's a matter of wisdom and effectiveness, right? Because that doesn't mean if we just started running around downtown saying, you know, Jesus died for your sin, repent and be saved. Well, they may not have any idea what those terms mean, right? So yes, we're saying something that's accurate, but it's not going to be effective for most people, right? So, but the other extreme of that, of always doing it, is never doing it until we've established this long thing. And so what we have to do is we have to pray and ask God for wisdom to know when do we do that, or learning from trial and error, doing it well sometimes, doing it poorly, and always asking questions, always investing and learning about people to where we know the kinds of things that could give us in that direction, and where we're learning about the person, we're showing genuine interest in them, we're showing them we genuinely love them, and if we do that, we're going to have a lot more opportunities, whether those are opportunities to just do a small thing, like what you're saying with the work situation, where we're just planting a seed, or whether it's going all the way to sharing the gospel with someone. It's going to be different in each situation, and so we need to have wisdom, but we don't go into it with, well, I'm just meeting this person, so there's no way I can share the gospel with them. Or the other extreme of, well, if I have this conversation, I may never see this person again, so if I don't just say the gospel now, they may never hear it. While that may be true, if we know they're in a situation where that gospel is not going to make any sense, or it's going to be confusing, or even worse, it's going to push them away from God, then it may not be wise to, because they don't know what it means, right? And so it's actually really hard. It's not clear and it's not easy, but we need to be intentional in loving people and getting to know them and knowing how to push them closer, back to our chutes and ladders analogy, and not further away. But we also need to have boldness when it is time to share, and this is where we could get take a cue from Brenda, that we do need to be willing to, even if it's scary, at the point where it does make sense. Dan?
One of the things I think I'll see a lot of, my perspective, is a confusion of what I would call categories.
Okay.
And, you know, in my job, I work with probably half the people I encounter are homosexual.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll say that. Maybe not quite that many.
But it seems like a lot.
And they're in the back. About probably half or more are.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a huge difference between the body of Christ opposing a movement that wants to normalize sin,
right,
and dealing one-on-one,
yep,
with anyone, whether they're committing adultery or
mm-hmm.
whatever.
Right.
Sharing the gospel, or just
right.
you know, from the perspective of,
right.
of a loving perspective. I always say many times I love myself too much to share the gospel.
Yes. Love your comfort and ease. Yeah. It's... because the problem is their idea, that the ideas are the enemy, not the person, right? And the one who's at least in part behind some of those ideas. I think that's what 2 Corinthians 10 is getting at. The weapons of warfare, not of the flesh, but have divine power to destroy strongholds. We destroy arguments and every lofty opinion raised against the knowledge of God. It's those bad ideas that affect people that are the problem we need to be prepared to fight against, not the people. Now, we have to deal with the people who are propagating them, whether it's in a situation where we're very lovingly, or sometimes we have to be more intentional in dealing with them on a bigger stage. But, Paul?
I think Danny brings up an interesting point, and I think it kind of gets to what your next question was that I don't think we ever really got to. It's because it was like, what are some of the hiccups or the
right.
or issues?
Right.
And I think one of the, and you were kind of just referring to it, is many of the things that the Christian worldview sees as problematic,
mm-hmm.
whether it's homosexuality or it's women's choice or whatever.
Right.
Our world, I think through, and it's been going back hundreds of years,
mm-hmm.
through the Enlightenment, people define themselves by the ideas that they have about themselves.
Right.
Right? So for the Christian world to say that we don't want traditional marriage to be
changed. Right.
The other world says, I am what I think I am.
Right.
And therefore, when you say that, you're saying that against me.
You're attacking me.
Right.
Right.
So I think one of the biggest challenges that we have is,
right.
and whether it's choice or it's orientation or it's sexuality, whatever it is, the world has the secular world has convinced people that they are defined by what they think.
Mm-hmm.
And so for us to be able to speak at that level, I think is really the challenge, because we can have good arguments and we can have facts and truth.
Right.
But the reality is they're living in an alternate reality.
Yeah. And their value, right, their value for them is tied up in their identity, right? And that's not just homosexual. That's a lot of people. That's people chasing wealth, status, influence, whatever. That's common everywhere. What's easier about someone who's caught up in something like homosexuality, I think, compared to someone who, let's say, is looking for status and wealth, is I think it's actually easier to reach the person and to see the person, the brokenness and the inability of that value to deliver. Because that's the thing, is it doesn't really deliver. And that's why there's a lot of brokenness in people who are chasing that and putting their identity in something else. And so if we can use that as a context to say, look, you have value apart from that. That doesn't define who you are. And I'm not saying that as an attack against you. I'm saying that to affirm you in it doesn't matter. That aspect is irrelevant to why you are valuable in the eyes of God and therefore in my eyes. Just because you are made in God's image, that's it. There's nothing else that needs to be there. You're valuable just because of that. Because what happens when you put your identity and you can see this, we can see this in our own lives, but think of people you know that are really chasing after it, where when their identity is in that thing they do or that aspect about them, when that's going really well, then they feel like they're amazing. And then when that goes terrible, then they feel terrible and they're worthless and all that, because their identity is tied in something extrinsic that is going to go up and down. It's going to not always be there. And so to be able to deliver that and to have that message of you're valuable no matter what, you are loved no matter what, that's not a reason to just do whatever, but that you are genuinely loved in spite of those things, is something very few people will have heard, and it won't be easy for them to even comprehend, but if we can get through, it's very powerful. And so that gives us a context in which we can have those spiritual conversations. Another thing that comes up a lot as far as more of a reason to reject is the suffering, pain and evil, whatever it might be. Often you're more adamant atheists, this is going to be something that's pretty strong for them. I find there's often a story behind why that's the case. There've been, you know, especially for ones that were raised in a church, it's something like they were in church and they had someone close to them who got sick, cancer or something, but you know, as long as they had faith and everyone prayed, they were going to be healed, and then the person never gets healed and they die, and well, now God isn't there, or he doesn't like us, or whatever it might be, and then that starts, that's at least the start of going down that path, and they end up in this place where that becomes the reason there couldn't be a God. But I think that situation gives us a great context for the why it does matter. And some of you have probably heard the story, but I think it does a good job of illustrating it, so I'll share it again. I was in South Africa, and we were doing teaching at a university, Northwest University in Potchefstroom, and I was in a men's dorm. There were probably about 50 or 60 students that were sitting, and I did a small talk on just God and science. Can you have both God and science, or are science and faith in conflict, kind of? Just very cursory, and then we were going to do Q&A on anything. And we ended up doing about 3 hours of Q&A because there were so many questions. And it was a bit of a mix, but it was a small number of committed Christians, a large number of nominal Christians, and then a small number of skeptics, two or three of which might have been very outwardly atheistic. And one in particular just kept lobbing volleys, you know, objections after objection throughout the whole course of things. And by the time that we had gotten further along, some of the other people that were with me came, so we broke up into groups rather than me doing it all with everyone so we could take more questions. And so this guy came to my group, and kind of his final, what he thought was going to be the coup de grace, that this is it. Okay, well, you've answered every other question, but this one, there's no way to answer. And so he said, he was quoting another atheist writer who said something along the lines of, when I see a child in Africa with his belly swollen and his eye being eaten out by a worm, it's obvious to me that God doesn't exist. And so I said, okay, so then you would agree with me that the world is not the way that it should be. And he said, absolutely. And so things like that, you know, famine and disease, that shouldn't happen, right? He said, yeah, we shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't have to deal with that. Okay, and I said, okay, so now how do you as an atheistic naturalist know, and I had stressed that too, and I said, and you know it should be this, it shouldn't be this way, right? And he said, yeah. And I said, okay, now how on atheistic naturalism do you know that the world should be a different way? And he just paused. And it wasn't lost on him. It was a dead silence. And the jaw drop, that's the first time in a conversation I've seen the literal. Like, his mouth just hung open, and he looked up. And then he said, I see what you did there. I said, I agree with you that it shouldn't. I can make sense out of that. You can't, but you're right, and you know you're right. You absolutely know that the brokenness in this world is there, and it is brokenness. It's not the way that it should be, but how should it be then? And how do you have any knowledge of that? On your view, you can't explain any of that. It's just the way it is. It's not even wrong. It's just unfortunate. We could maybe use that terminology, but it's not wrong. I said, the difference for me is that on Christianity, I can explain that it didn't start out that way, how it got that way, that it can serve a purpose right now, right? Acknowledging, because the problem is not the suffering and the pain. The problem is that that points to the real problem, which is that we're separated from God, that there's sin and brokenness in the world, and that there's resolution to it. I said, your worldview can't account for any of those things. But you know just as strongly as I do that they're there. Right? And so this thing that actually seems like it often is this barrier is really just a way of them acknowledging that something's wrong. And so we can just say, I agree with you. We don't have to get into this defensive mode of trying to justify why God does this one or that one or, you know, getting into that discussion. I think that we're going through Job is interesting on that conversation. But it's... So then you recognize that this should be different. I'm with you. Where do we have that common ground? And starting there, and then saying, but the thing is, that doesn't lead to your view, that leads you to my view. And on your view, there is no resolution. It's just what happens. he ended up, the students continued to reach out to him. I haven't heard an update recently, so I know students who'd been talking to him still as of probably a couple of years ago, and he had slowly been softening his position. I don't know where he's at right now, but he certainly saw he could not use that anymore. They said he started trying to bring up switch to other types of things, but that's part of it is, even if you have someone who is just looking for an excuse not to believe, by dealing with those things, they can't knowingly, or they have to knowingly suppress that or stop using it, but they can't just keep hiding behind it anymore. They've been exposed. And if that's all we do, that actually can be really fruitful, because now they can't, because when I refer back to my situation. When I would ask, how do you know that you even have what they wrote 2,000 years ago from the Bible, right? Until that question was resolved, I think I was actually reasonable. Now, in the grand scheme of things, I was wrong, but I was reasonable to say, I'm not going to change my whole life and put my eternal destiny in a book. You don't even know how you got it? That's actually very reasonable. Yes. Very reasonable. So until that's corrected, even though I was wrong, and there were other things, thankfully, that would brought me around to that. It wasn't, I wasn't looking for an excuse not to believe, but that was certainly why I wasn't going to just take whatever from the Bible as, oh, well, if it's in the Bible, I got to believe it. You couldn't even tell me how you got what is in the Bible. So I'm not going to believe anything from it necessarily. Okay, so that if that's there, well, in those situations where it's a problem of evil or suffering or whatever it might be, even if the person is using that just as an excuse to not believe, which is a different situation than I was in, because I was open to it, I just needed reasons. People who are volitionally saying, I don't want to believe, what's the excuse I can come up with? Well, once you expose that, now they're exposed, and even if they don't change outwardly, that's there in their head, right, and in their soul, in their conscience, and it is their, Greg Kokel calls it a rock in their shoe, right? They can never shake that unless they completely go into the Romans 1, suppressing the truth and unrighteousness. And at that point, you know, there's not much you can do.
Two very quick things. One is a quick finger wag of those of you who grew up in church. You don't know what it's like. I grew up in church. That's my point. I was invited to Sunday school. I went, and afterwards, the person who brought me introduced me to the Sunday school teacher, and he said, any questions, anything I can help you with? I was not a believer at the time. So I thought, yeah, under the guise of curiosity, I lobbed a couple of stump questions, like, you know, of the nature of can God make a rock? So, you know, but how come God created light, but then he created the sun, verse 16? How come? And the guys, and I, the way I looked at it was the insiders to Christianity have to know there's no God. That's the reason I wagged my finger at you for not having grown up in a Christian home. You're missing a mindset. There's no telling what the unbeliever might believe. Like, I thought, insiders to Christianity, they have to know, like the Wizard of Oz, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. I figured, I'm going to get this guy to scramble by asking him a question he's going to trip up over. And I asked him, so how come God created light before he created the sun? And he says, I don't know. And I was shocked that he gave me the answer.
Right.
Just like, he says, maybe God created light and sustained it, and then created the sun to sustain it on its own. So how come Moses, how come Moses, you know, supposedly wrote the first five books of the Bible, but his death is recorded in the fifth one? I'm thinking, it's like, hey, wait, let's see, deal with that one. And he said, I don't know. He says, it could be that God foretold Moses ahead of time. It could be Joshua's right-hand man finished up. I kind of think Joshua finished up. He says, but I really don't know. I'm like, oh my gosh, he really believes this. He's really reasoning through this. That was something that had never occurred to me, that it was something that people intelligently believed.
Mm-hmm.
And what was his answer to my question? I don't know. But the way I was like, wow, he'd be honest here. So that's one of two things. So never forget to address even the crazy questions. And even with an I don't know, because you don't know
right. What
crazy apple cart you might be tipping over. B is that they know that this is false. Wow.
And probably in that situation, don't add but I just have faith. Because...
Yeah, under pull rug.
Right.
Second thing is on the topic of dealing with questions, you know, what kind of God would let a world like this go on? We had a contractor working in our house, not a contractor, an hourly laborer. For months he was helping us build addition. A couple times he brought his teenage kids to work along with him, and we got to be involved socially with him, and we were sitting one time, and he said, you know, some God, he would be, if there was a God, some God to let the world go on like this, what kind of God would he be? I said, yeah, the world's a mess, all right. I said, you know, I know you brought your teenage boys to the job a couple times. He says, yeah. I said, I noticed they can get to scrapping a little bit, too. He says, oh, my gosh, they go at it. I said, some father you are. he said, what do you mean, some father I am? I said, some father you must be. You know, them scrapping the way they do. He says, I don't control them. I said, you telling me you couldn't stop it? He says, well, if I tied each one of them to a tree 20 feet apart, I could stop it. I said, well, so why don't you? He says, what kind of life would that be for them? And I said, they could still say nasty things to each other. Can you stop that? Well, yeah, but I'd have to put gags on it, but what kind of thing would that be? I'm like, yeah. Oh. Very simple. Use what he already knows.
Right.
Put him in God's position. It's like, how would you do it?
Right.
You say you can't do it, but you can. What kind of father are you? It makes no sense for me to stop him. Ding, you're getting it.
Right. Yep. Yeah, and as we, you know, it's in different people are going to have strengths in different areas. If it's someone with a major emotional need, I'm not going to be as good at helping that person. And so don't think you've got to be the best for everyone. But we need to be thinking, how do we intentionally make ourselves so that we're going to be better equipped to reach whoever it is, even if we're still better in certain situations than others? And we can't use it as an excuse as, oh, well, I'm not, you know, I'm not very intelligent, so I couldn't ever answer any questions. Or for me, I'm not very emotional, so I can't help people with emotional problems. Being honest.
Within a week, I said, you know what? Instead of getting God to come through my hoops, God, if you keep this pencil from falling, if you make it hover, I'll believe. Instead of me putting God on the stand and asking him to do my stuff, maybe I should do what he's asking.
Right.
And within like 3 days of that Sunday school time I told you about, I whipped around. I'm like, God, I'm going to do what I think you want. And I'll just do whatever you want. And 2 days later, I realized, oh, shoot, I didn't say anything about forgiveness of sins. I better cross my eyes. But if it wasn't clear 2 days ago, God, I asked forgiveness for my sins.
Right.
And if there was a turning point, it was that I found out this guy really believes that. I had been going under the false notion that there's no God, and the insiders really know there's not. And a simple, I don't know, got that turned around.
Yep. And I don't know, that's a good question. You know, this might be a way, but yeah. And then, you know, talking about, and we'll close on this, so thinking of the why does it matter, then again, from our perspective, trying to, as best we can, think about what's the why does it matter for what they're saying, especially if it's a criticism of Christianity. So, like the Moses, how did he write the first five books if his death is recorded in the fifth one? Well, what does that have to do with whether Jesus rose from the dead or not? You know, this might be an answer, but can you tell me how does that affect whether Jesus rose from the dead? Because that's what Christianity is really about. I think Moses did, and I'm not going to hide from that. I think Moses did write the first five books. But that's not what saves someone is believing Moses wrote the first five books. I think what saves someone is accepting the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ and his death for their sins. That's the issue. And just that's the turning the why doesn't matter back on them, but then being prepared to answer the why doesn't matter from our side of things. And so if what we're leading with, and this is where we run into the problems, I don't have a problem taking a stand on some of the political stuff, but when we lead with it, in a way where people think that's what we're about. Or let's take the young earth, age of the earth controversy. People that hold a young earth view, which I know many very intelligent people that do, very even scientists that do. But when we make that, and I've seen people of that persuasion that use that as their issue to get to the God, like, they start using that to try and disprove evolution to then like somehow make Christianity be true. And the bottom line is, well, so what? Even if you could disprove evolution, you haven't proved Christianity's true. So why would we lead with that? That doesn't make any sense. We're leading with something that necessarily can't even get us the essentials for the gospel. So even if we were right and we could convince them, we still haven't proven Christianity. And so in the things that we're doing and saying, obviously, we can talk about issues that aren't that, but thinking about how are we coming off to people and what are we saying to the world is it really about? And how do we take a stand on some of these things while making clear that that's not the core, that's not the most essential part of Christianity. It's an outflow of what the core is. And that is very tricky and nuanced and is going to take wisdom in each and every situation, but I think that as we approach it that way, it's going to be helpful.
I understand the tact you're taking, but it's been tried before.
As in?
Tried many times, and the United States as a whole has rejected the church.
Mm-hmm.
It's been rejected.
Mm-hmm.
We've tried this before. So why do you keep doing the same thing over and over again?
Precisely define what it is.
The church itself,
mm-hmm.
if it wants to get people in the pews,
mm-hmm.
we have to do it not by promotion, but attraction.
Okay.
If your promotion is by attraction, then that's probably the best way to do it. In order to have that, we have to have something they want.
Okay.
And we're hypocrites.
Mm-hmm.
We're Bible thumpers.
Mm-hmm.
That's not going to get anybody in the pew.
Mm.
It's been tried. And you're not going to be able to teach them the word if they're not sitting in that chair, if they're sitting at home.
Yeah.
And there's also there's something even more dangerous is if you beat them over the head.
Mm-hmm.
and they reject it, or they try it and they walk out the back door, they'll never come back.
Right. Yeah, so here's the, I think actually the bigger problem behind that, and this is where it gets harder and messier and trickier for us, is I'll qualify this. I'm not concerned about getting people in the pews. I'm concerned about getting the people in the pews actually out in their lives, living out a true life of discipleship and gospel in their lives, so that's where the change is made, and then those people are brought into the church to be brought up and equipped and trained. I think the problem is, one of the major problems in America, in the West probably in general, but certainly in America, is we have made Christianity almost exclusively about bringing people in, and that's where the magic has to happen, and that's where the work's done. And so the average Christian does their part in evangelism by trying to get their neighbor to come to church. And so that what we then have to do is we have to make church appealing to non-saved people, because that's the only way we're going to get them in. So I'm not criticizing you with this. This is a major issue.
I understand that. I mean, I guess the question I would have is, do we have in this church what somebody else wants? If somebody walks in this church,
right,
sits down in a pew, do they come back?
Yeah.
If they see something in their life that is missing, is there something in this church that attracts somebody to stay?
Well, what's that?
If you send somebody out there and they don't have the root system,
okay, which is necessary, right,
which is the
church,
get fed, because the church is there to feed the people who are going out.
Yes.
Because the world's going to beat the living crap out of them.
Right, right.
Out there, you might lose that person.
Yeah, so don't get me wrong. I'm not saying in the end it's not, but I don't think the goal of what happens in the church should not be getting more non-saved people into the church, necessarily, the building, but equipping the people who are in the building to go out in their lives to be able to make an impact and then bring those people in. And what what the core thing that should be in a church that will connect them, that is something that's useful, is relationship. I mean, there should be people, they should be able to make connection. Now, if they come and they don't talk to anyone or whatever and they just leave, right, that's going to be hard. But that's why I think what's going to be most effective is if we're actually having real relationships and we're forming real depth with someone outside of the church, and then we bring them in, then that's already there.
Church is ready.
Oh, yeah. No, that's right.
The church designed here to, is it prepared?
Yes, right, right.
For people to come in.
Ah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
What they want.
Right.
Will they just come in and go, well, I really like this guy that talked to me in the church, but I don't see anything I want in the church.
I guess.
We don't entirely have control. We don't have control over them, but we do have control.
Well, and I guess that depends on what that's mean, because I'm going to both say I want to know who they are, where they are, what their needs are, and therefore what they want. And I also want to say I don't really care what they want, because it may be so far out of line with what they actually need that it's irrelevant. Now, how do we square that? Because if we have someone who wants something totally antithetical to what the church is, then how do we reach that person? Well, we have to find a way to penetrate those barriers before bringing them into this environment, because this environment is never going to satisfy them if what they think they want is completely antithetical to it. Now,
I'm talking like Joel Holstein. You know, that's not what I'm shooting for. I mean,
sure,
he's got a little
right
dig that he does, and it works for, you know,
right.
Prosperous and.
But I would say, I mean, to your point, I would say here, I don't think we're near as ready. Like, we're going to have to take some intentional steps before we really start doing outreach. We've been talking about this. So mostly, I mean, and one aspect that I think is challenging here, because most of the people here have been in church most of their lives, and it's just sort of second nature. We know how it goes. We know the flow and all of that. So what we've been talking about doing is some sort of, whether you would call it a new believers class or a Christian basics, something to where you say, hey, here's what we do, and here's why. And when I'm doing it, especially, I can tell them, some of this is going to be really weird and uncomfortable. And that's okay. You're not weird because you think it's uncomfortable. That's what I thought when I started going to church. I thought, this is really awkward. This is totally different than anything I've ever done before. These people are weird. They're raising their hands. They're like, what in the world? And this was after I had already began to believe. And I'm still thinking, this is awkward. I would sit in the back. I was, you know, like, I do not know what's going on. And it took a long time for me to get over that because I didn't understand why this was all happening. It was so new. And so part of it is up front admitting this isn't necessarily going to be. Now, if we make it like a concert, then it might be you're not going to feel as awkward because it's going to be so much like a concert that it's going to be very clear. You can sort of avoid the other stuff. But when it's not, when it's a smaller church and it's just worship music, you got to kind of just deal with it. And so there are things about that. And so that's part of what we've talked about as the process is what are those things of being able to say to people, hey, if you haven't been in church in a long time or never, this is going to be different. And that's okay. And don't be afraid to tell us that. Don't be afraid to say, why do people keep saying this phrase? Why do people use this phrase? It doesn't make any sense to me. I don't know what they mean. It sounds really weird. That's okay. But where I think what we have to do is what we have to create is an environment where there's an openness to where people are comfortable saying those things rather than just thinking them and then walking out the door. So that's going to be on everyone individually and then us corporately. But I think you're touching on some very important things. I think the answer most of the church is offering is not going to make long-term impact. I think the churches that operate in a way where they are the most appealing to unsaved people, and I've tracked some of this, they don't make a very good long-term impact in most of those people's life. They might come for longer than one weekend, but there are a lot of people in those types of situations that come in, whoa, this is new and exciting, they sort of get on this high from it, and then that high delivers diminishing returns over time, and then they trickle out. So it might be instead of a 1 week or 2 weeks, it's 6 months or 8 months, but I think there's actually just as big of a problem. It's just they can keep the numbers flowing through so consistently that we don't notice it. But I trust that if we faithfully prepare ourselves to reach out as individuals from this church in our lives, and we have an intentional plan for how that is going to create an opportunity to bring people back in here, and then we have a way to invest in them, and that is going to take some work. And that I would admit, even as, you know, as potentially becoming one of the elders, we're not at the place where we have all that. But that's what it's going to take, and that will make a bigger impact even if we have less numbers, because then those people can then become a part of that process, even if they don't stay here long term, right? That's not what we're concerned about. But if you can get someone who actually grows and not just comes and experiences something but actually grows, then they will be able to, that will make more of a difference in the end, even if it's a smaller number. So, but I'll close up because I think we're way over time. Good questions, good comments. And I'll stick up here and chat. I just want to officially end things because I think we're way over. Well,